Only mode.
Hi everyone, we're going to get straight into it today. Ron Manabat's going to do the introduction and I'll hand straight over to you, Ron.
Thanks, John. First of all, I want to thank everybody for joining us, I know, on your lunch hour today to learn a little bit more about some of these cash flow properties that are up in North Dakota. So I'm not going to steal our guest's thunder, but just really quickly, North Dakota has really been a hotbed of activity in terms of energy and the oil reserves that have been discovered in that area of the United States. In fact, it's been said that that is actually the largest oil reserve in the United States, and I guess that's exciting on many fronts, but needless to say, there's just a lot of opportunity in terms of employment, jobs, population growth, and I know that Australians really will appreciate is the fact that many of you have experienced, say, some of these smaller mining communities where you had the mining booms and you had these man camps. That all happened several years ago and still is in play, particularly as some of these oil rigs are following an oil, they're following a flow in terms of how going deeper into the shale, going further south. But there's a lot of permanent housing that's coming into play, and I think that's the part that everybody is most excited about. It's not just, hey, we're going to mine this or drill this and then game over. They expect this to be generating and producing oil for many years to come. So with that, I'm just going to hand it over to our guest, John. Let me actually add one other thing. North Dakota, it has, I'll have to say, it's kind of I guess the best way to describe it is a little bit like the Wild Wild West. And for many of you who know me, part of my responsibilities are going out to different markets, trying to identify who's operating in these markets, evaluating the product, and making a determination of, hey, is this a group that we're willing to work with? Well, John has a long-standing relationship with us at the Real Wealth Network, and happy to put him in front of you guys today to tell you about what he has to offer. But we trusted his judgment, but in a place where there are a lot of partly unscrupulous people, partly incompetent people, and partly just too many people, John's breadth and knowledge and research in that particular area is a tremendous value. So with that, John, please, the stage is yours.
Thanks a lot, Ron. Well, I'm excited to be here talking to Australians again. It's been a little while, but I know that I think that the appetite I've seen from Australians has been expressed because their yields aren't as strong as they are in the U.S., and now I think anyone who's been watching various markets in the United States has kind of come to realize that yields are getting squeezed across the country because we're not seeing the discounts that we were before. So if we are seeing those yields, they're paper yields, and we're typically getting them in high-risk areas where typically the crime rates are higher or the schools are bad or some combination thereof. So, and that kind of leads me into how I found North Dakota, a little bit about what we're going to do, though. I don't know if Ron, Kathy typically does the disclaimer. Did you want to do the disclaimer, or should I just do this real quick? All right, so our
disclaimer. No, you can breeze through it. I mean, again, nothing is guaranteed in real estate or any investment.
Yeah, you can lose money. Nobody is in it giving legal advice and tax advice. So, buyer beware. Just make sure you do your homework. And on that note, everything that I talk about today is going to be hopefully just a trigger for you to validate everything that you're seeing here. And if you've done any homework in North Dakota, you know that there is no lack of information out there when it comes to all the media hype. But I can refer you to some places where you can get some empirical information on what's happening with gas and oil production in the area, because at the end of the day, everything starts with that, and then job growth, population growth, unemployment follows. Of course, the housing crunch is also behind that as well. So today, what you can expect very quickly is, number one, we're going to talk about, we're going to go from macro down to micro story. The macro story basically consists of what's happening in North Dakota from the energy front. And one of my mentors in the area who does some private money lending and is also investing in a lot of the train rail infrastructure up there said to me, you know, John, you're in real estate, but when you come out here, regardless of what specialty we have to understand that this is an oil business and we just happen to be doing it in the context of whatever our specialties are, in this case real estate. So we have to understand the energy play and the sustainability of it more than anything before we can even do what we do best in real estate. Because if we do everything right, but we do it at the wrong time or in the wrong place, it doesn't matter how well we do from a myopic perspective, if we're swimming upstream or against the stream or against the grain, it's trouble for us. So we had to make sure that the stream was right and that the longevity was there in the big picture, everything fit. We're going to talk about the risks up there. I'll talk to you a little bit from a commercial asset manager's perspective. Then we're going to go into the actual properties, which a lot of you are probably most interested in seeing. You want to see the numbers. You want to see the actual physical houses and the rental properties. We'll also talk about property management as well. And then we'll talk about next steps. I'll hand it back to John. So as far as the black gold rush goes, that's exactly what we call it up there in North Dakota. As Ron said, you do have a lot of people up there who are just don't have the skill set to execute. There's a lot of barriers of entry. So you have very harsh weathers in North Dakota with about a 6 month to 8 month window to do site work and excavation and so forth, which kind of limits how much product you can actually put out there. You have problems getting infrastructure and services to your land, so that limits development in the area. And everything is kind of in reaction mode still up there when it comes to putting in infrastructure and getting product up to accommodate this housing crunch that we're seeing there. And I'm going to talk a little bit to the numbers here in a second. But to come back to how I found the area is, you know, being from Orlando, Florida, is where I'm based. We've been helping investors buy high-yielding properties with a property management solution, a local property management solution to take care of those houses for our investors. A lot of these investors are coming from other countries: Canada, Israel, Australia, the UK, Brazil, South Africa, and then a lot of these investors are coming from California, the Northeast in the United States, of course, Canada too. But all of them, what's common among all of them is they need good local property management. So we've been helping investors find properties across the United States, these high-yielding properties, and we've been getting squeezed out of various markets since 2009 and 10 when the prices have gone up and the rents haven't gone up proportionately as fast. And when that happens, of course, you get yield compression. So we jump from one market to the next market to the next market, and what's also been pushing us from market to market, which is what I wrote about as a contributing author to the book there with Brian Tracy, is how these hedge funds and these private equity firms are moving across the country and pretty much pushing the smaller investors out. So we found ourselves in a couple of the peripheral markets here in the United States with yields getting squeezed and had to look for other markets. So I'd always been keeping an eye on other markets with long-term higher yields potentials and growth potential. And that's kind of how we found the Bakken region. But the Bakken oil region up there in North Dakota, of course, if you've never been there before, there's actually, you know, if I'm on an airplane, I'm flying around regardless where I'm going in the U.S., I'd say only about a third of the people I talk to know about the area. And everybody's fearful, or everybody hears about these oil booms, these 10-year booms that turned into 4-5-year busts. And so we were very leery coming into that market, and we had to spend a lot of time assessing the risks. So what I want to start with, kind of give you a backdrop to the conversation we're going to have today, is a story about selling hamburgers. Now, I don't know if any of you are marketers out there, but if you've ever heard of Gary Halbert, he has since passed away, but he was known as the Prince of Prints. Meaning that he could write copy for a CD player, a women's pantyhose. He could write copy for an online sales page. He was just a very strong copywriter to get people to take action. He was doing a seminar. He had a lot of marketing gurus in his conference, and he posed the question to his audience, all these online gurus. He said, if we were to compete selling hamburgers, and I was going to have a hamburger stand and you're going to have a hamburger stand, what are some of the advantages that you would want to outsell me in hamburgers? So I'll give the audience a couple seconds to think about that. So as you'd expect, some of the answers that came up were, I want the ability to finance my hamburgers, some really creative advantages. Some other common ones were, I want a better location, I'd want better ingredients, I want better employees, I want a special recipe. And so all of these advantages were popping out of the audience, and Gary simply told his group, I will give you all of those advantages, and I just want one. And the one advantage that he'd want over everybody else is to sell more hamburgers than everybody else is a starving crowd. So that said, the Bakken region has a starving audience. You'll hear me reference a starving crowd through the presentation. The number one risk that we had to assess was how long are we going to see this starving crowd up there. When we look at supply, we look at demand, we look at potential resistance to fracking up there. And so those are some of the risks that we had to assess coming into the market. And I'm going to go over a few of them just very quickly, something that you can actually validate. I always tell my audiences, never take anything I tell you by face value. Just use it as maybe a reference for you to further validate on your own. But one of the things that we found out very quickly was that the oil prices, as long as they're staying north of, I've heard as low as $35 up to about $55 a barrel, then we're going to have a sustainable play. Oil companies will stay profitable and they'll keep drilling. And everywhere I've done presentations and talked to investors, I haven't run into one that suspects that we're going to be below $55 per barrel anytime soon. And if we do, it won't be for very long. Second risk was you hear about environmental resistance to fracking. And if you look at the science of what their fracking looks like up there, the why behind that resistance a lot of times has to do with what you see on documentaries and with natural gas fracking. Typically in Pennsylvania and New York, where you have fracking or drilling that takes place within 1,500 feet from the surface of the land, where you have the water tables. And so you hear a lot of those horror stories about people being able to light fires out of their water faucets, which doesn't even come close to happening in North Dakota. In North Dakota, all you have to do is go to YouTube, type in oil fracking, and you can even type in Bakken or North Dakota, and you'll see all kinds of scientific explanations of how they do that. And one thing that they do up there in North Dakota is they go about, first of all, the first 1,500 feet, they cap with two cement barriers and two steel barriers. Then they take a 4-inch pipe and they go 2 miles down, and then they go 2 miles across horizontal. The horizontal fracking is actually what stimulated the boom that we just had, because oil in the region had been known since 1951. Just was never profitable to explore it because horizontal fracking hadn't been around yet, which is a lot more profitable. So the point I'm making is that environmental resistance is not, number one, because of the physical way that the fracking is happening up there. As deep as they're going, they're isolating the drilling from the water tables and not interrupting the water tables up there. So it's a completely different kind of fracking that you see on all the documentaries. Plus, the political climate in North Dakota, you just have to understand up there, it's very conservative, Bible-thumping, gun-touting state, very conservative kind of mindset. I'd liken it actually probably a little bit to Australia, where you don't like telling outsiders what you can and can't do. That's kind of the political climate up there. And to kind of give you an idea of what that's like, how that translates locally, it takes about 1 month to get a license to drill in North Dakota. The neighboring state of Montana, where you have some of the overlap of the Bakken shale formation, where they're also drilling, takes about 8 months to get a license to drill. Completely different climate altogether. So the environmental resistance wasn't something that worried about. Production sustainability, I'll go over some quick math with you today, but at the end of the day, if you follow the rigs are what drill the wells, and you know how many wells they anticipate drilling based on our current recovery rates, then you can do some very simple math to guesstimate with educated guess on how long the play is going to last up there. And I'll talk to you about that in a second. That was one of our least concerns. We're still at the bottom of the first inning. That's baseball talk for those of you that understand American baseball. I don't know what the equivalent is in cricket. Maybe, John, you can help me with that. It's basically early in the game. So then the other risk is people, and Ron hinted at this a little bit. What you have in North Dakota with the gold rush up there, if you will, is a bunch of people trying to hit sixes. I think that's the I think that's actually a cricket term. So they're trying to hit sixes instead of just score small points here and there like we would do in any other market, which means that you have what you have up there. I call it the land of the missing left socks, is you have a lot of developers who aren't resourced and don't necessarily have the skill sets or the leadership team or the subcontractor base to execute on a real estate project. They have great ideas, great plans, great intentions, but they just they always hit walls up there, and so very few people can execute. And vetting people, I found, is a lot more critical in that climate than it is anywhere else in the country, where we're just looking at sticks and bricks, physical inspections, and Excel spreadsheets. So that was something. It took me a year and a half, just to kind of give you an idea, a year and a half to do anything in that region. 12 visits later, 18 months until we did our first deal up in the Bakken, and it was mainly because of the people. We'd get a few steps ahead, and then we'd have to take 4 steps back because we'd find something out about somebody, or someone let us down, or in our due diligence process something happened. So we've kind of gotten past that, so we're past the biggest barrier of entry, which is basically connecting with the right people locally. The last risk, which is on everybody's mind all the time, is yield compression. At what point does the supply catch up with the demand for housing, and as a result, my rents go down, and then my yield goes down? And that was the number one of all of those risks. That was the number one most sensitive risk that we pretty much narrowed our research down to. So I'm going to speak to that a little bit to give you a little bit of confidence like we have now on the longevity of the yields that we're seeing. So the Bakken region, if you're not familiar with the region, you have more reserves in this area, like Ron said, than anywhere else in the country. You, someone also said that there is more oil underground than even Saudi Arabia up there in North Dakota. The problem is our recovery rate, basically what we can capture, is only, it started out as only about 3 to 3.5%. It's actually almost doubled to nearly 7% of what's underground. And that's over 11 billion barrels of oil right now. So huge reserves up there. And if you translate the number of recoverable barrels of oil and how they're drilling those wells and the number of wells they have to drill, here's what basically happens. So you have 187, it used to be about 200, now we're down about 187 rigs. Rigs are what drill those wells. And they can only drill at a pace of about 2,100 wells per year. Well, at the density that they're drilling right now, the number of wells per oil pad, it's going to take us about, they're going to have to drill about 100,000 wells. Some people say even up to 150. I'm just using a conservative estimate. At 100,000 wells, if you can only do 2,100 per year, then you're nearly 50 years of active drilling, which means 50 years of temporary jobs. It means 50 years of permanent jobs to maintain the wells already done, and then they're always going back and re-stimulating or refracking wells that have already drilled. So the two counties that we're physically paying most attention to is Williams County and McKenzie County, because if the oil was or the shale formations underground, and by the way, the Bakken is just the first layer. You actually have multiple layers below the Bakken region. They're also drilling right now into the Three Forks formation, which is the three layers below the Bakken. So everybody knows the area is the Bakken, but just keep in mind that's just the first layer. So the whole formation was shaped like an ice cream cone underneath the ground, the tip of the ice cream cone, the deepest part of that formation where the most reserves are going to be in McKenzie County and Williams County, which is, again, where we're focusing. The city of Williston is in Williams County, which is on the north here. They're saying that about 30 billion barrels are underground there. So that's where we're going to focus. If you look at the electricity demand over the next 20 years, you can kind of see where all the infrastructure is going in right now, and it's all in that western side of the state. It basically follows the drilling. Any of these graphs you can see online, there's just so much of the information out there. If you want to do your own research, a good place to start is WillistonDevelopment.com. You can get all kinds of resources there on population growth, on housing, on the employment rates, and so forth. But as you can see on the screen here, on the left side, you see the population growth since about 2009. The population has essentially tripled in the last 5 years at a growth rate on an annual basis similar to what you would see in major markets in the United States on a 10-year basis. It is the number one micropolitan market in the United States by measure of unemployment, economic activity, and population growth. You look at the unemployment rate in Williams County right now, it is only at 1%, the lowest in the country. As far as job growth goes and population growth, the graphs are very similar. You're going to see here that right now in 2014, here's where we are, about halfway up this incline, and it doesn't really plateau or slow down until we get to the mid-2020s. And by the way, every year that this graph has come out, they've taken the, we've landed at the most aggressive, they always have a conservative forecast and a median forecast and an aggressive forecast. Every year they have landed on the aggressive forecast on all of these charts. So a lot of what we're telling you is developing over time. They're just geologists are finding more formations and more oil underground, and hence that translates to, again, just more longevity in the play. If you want to look at what that translates to now as far as rents go and housing, you can just Google. All you have to do is Google Williston rents, type in New York, and one of the first articles that's going to pop up from New York Daily Times is going to be an article about the cost per foot with Williston rents exceeding our two most expensive markets in the United States, which is Los Angeles and New York. Here's what's happening from a numbers perspective. If you go to Williams County, there's a lot of housing there. Over the last few years, early in the play here, a few years ago when things were just getting started and you had people sleeping in their cars at Walmart, which they don't have anymore because things have stabilized a little bit, you had a lot of what we call high-density residential housing being built, man camps, RV parks, skid shacks were just kind of put everywhere, all of this temporary high-density housing. And now that things have kind of stabilized and the local areas aren't simply reacting to the chaos anymore, they're being more proactive, planning and zoning is a much bigger consideration now, that you're starting to see conditional use permits, basically temporary permission for you to have this not-so-pretty type of lodging. They're starting to expire. So now what's happening is you have, this shows you how many people, if you want to focus on the right side of this table, shows you how many people are in the various types of housing here. At the end of October 31st this year, you have a lot of those conditional use permits expiring. So what essentially that means is that in man camps, you're going to have a lot of your more established companies that have what we call dry camps, meaning no alcohol on site. They do a good job policing their residents. You don't have a lot of trouble out of those camps. They'll stick around because they can't get rid of all those structures, and they can't displace that many people right now. So you only lose about 1,000 people out of those types of housing. All the RV parks are going. That's about 4,000 residents. And then we have a miscellaneous of scattered RVs and skid shacks. That's another 1,000. So you have a total estimated almost 6,000 people displaced with about 4,700 units currently under construction. That includes apartments, permanent housing, which includes townhomes, twin homes, single family, and the like. And so of the 4,700 units under construction, that's going to leave you with about 1,228 people that don't have a place to live. And you're also going to have another, that doesn't account also for 3,000 people coming into the city on a yearly basis. So as you can see there, just from the numbers, there's going to be a lot of displaced folks, and that's why the properties there can charge a premium. Now, the properties there also cost a lot to build, because keep in mind that you only have so many months to build. You kind of have to work around the weather. You also don't have a lot of people that are up there that can your sub base, your electricians, your plumbers, your framers, all of those folks are very hard to find. So a lot of these builders are housing their staff on their properties. So you have housing costs. So your labor costs are higher, material costs are higher, and the price of land is higher, and it's still going up. So that's what's keeping the price of the homes up. A lot of people look at the price of homes, which, by the way, I kind of pinned it as the housing cost, if you're a developer, you're a builder, it's going to be about twice as much as the rest of the country on average. But your rents are about three times as much, and that's kind of how it plays up there. We don't see anything normalizing anytime in the next few years, because the land costs are still going to go up, and the material and labor costs may stabilize a little bit, but the land costs are going to offset that. So I always tell investors, just assume that what you're paying now is what you sell it for later as a worst case scenario, and you're going to have just high yields in the meantime with an exit plan later, and we'll talk about that in a second. So in the city of Williston, if you look at the city, here's kind of how it's shaped right here. The main corridor through Williston is Highway 85 and 2. They converge, they come down the city together, and they split off again on the southwest side of the city. 85 continuing on to Watford City, which is McKenzie County that I just showed you, and then 2 just extending west to Montana, about 30 minutes away. So the area that we're focusing on in Williston is just being in front of Progress. In the city, you have a major highway being finished. It's being cut and paved as we speak to take a lot of the traffic that's currently going through the city, around the city, to get through the state. So that truck bypass is going to bring a lot of commercial development around it. You also have the airport being relocated. To keep the airport currently where it is, it's going to cost the city, or cost the airport about $400 million, but to relocate it's going to be about $230 million. So almost half the price just to take it where they need it to extend the runways and the infrastructure and so forth to accommodate the new flights. So that's going to be relocated to the northwest. And you have the largest master plan development in all of North Dakota. North Star just broke ground about a month ago. We knew that was in the works as of probably about a year ago. And so this 530-acre master plan development is going to bring about 7 million square feet of commercial space and over 2,200 residential units to this market. It's going to transform the landscape. Between that, the truck bypass and the airport, all that's going to transform the landscape on the north side of town. So we're in front of Progress, focusing on just that area. If you come down to, with a little bit more of a microscope and zoom in on the community itself, what we like about the community is you have a solution for all your services, where a lot of communities out there don't have power, or they're having a hard time getting a sewage solution in place or water. All of that is already in place at the community called Fendi Estates, where we're focusing. If you look at the site plan, because we're just going to zoom in here, if you look at the site plan for the community, this is just part of it. It's going to encompass 700 total residential units. You can see kind of a sampling of what's in there on the screen there. The 700 units are going to consist of townhomes, twin homes, and single-family properties. So what I like about it is there are some communities up there that are where you could have there is no planning or zoning considerations or considerations to property values, where you might have a residential house, single-family home, and then an apartment building is put up right across the street from it, which devalues the single-family home. What I like about this community, it's a very clean residential community. It's only going to be residential. The builder is very particular about the community to kind of evidence that. He's built many communities before in Washington and California. It comes from a family of builders, and he has never named a community after his kids or after his last name. And the community is named after comes off of his last name. And the, some of the streets in the community, like Isabella, Christina, and Victoria, are named after his kids. So he has a lot of pride in the community. In the county area where he's built this community, doesn't require fire hydrants, but he put one up anyway. Typically, you have them about 600 feet from each other. He's got them 500 feet or less from each other. So kind of gives you an idea of the pride that he has in the community. He won't let modular builders build in the Infendi Estates because he's selling those lots to builders. He's not the only one building in there. You have other builders coming in, but he's very particular about what the product they're going to erect inside the community. So again, no modulars, no apartments, no manufactured housing, no temporary type of lodging. He wants to maintain the high property values in there. It is the only gated community in all of Williston. It's an electric gate, and right now it's open. They're going to have construction access for their construction vehicles shortly, and then that's when the gate's going to be fully operational. As far as the properties go, the availability we have right now are two-bedroom and three-bedroom townhomes. Essentially, what you're purchasing for $218,000 to about $260,000 is going to be a two-bedroom or a three-bedroom townhome between 1,000 up to about 1,400 square feet in size. And I'll go over those numbers for you in a sec. By the way, if you ever want the specs on the homes, or you want floor plans, or you want the cash flow sheets that I'm about to show you here, all you have to do is request. I'll be glad to get those to you along with a frequently asked question guide that answers 90% of the questions we get from our investors. But the Newport, which is the two-bedroom model, looks like this. You have about 1,000 square feet, as I mentioned, two levels, two bedrooms, one and a half bath. It does have a one-car garage. Parking and garages are very important, especially when the temperature can get down to negative 20 Fahrenheit. I don't know what that translates to in the Celsius. I don't know, John, maybe you can help me out with that one later. But the prices for the two bedrooms, again, $218,000. Your closing cost estimate about 2%. Your all-in total acquisition, if you paid cash, about $222,000. The rent on that property is going to be about $2,300 a month. And we're going to talk about the tenant placement guarantees in a second, which basically ensure that you have no vacancy risk with your first tenant from the time you close. You close on the property, you start collecting rents from day one. The management fees, 8%. We'll talk about management fees in a second. Your estimated tax is about $1,800 on that unit, $800 in insurance, and a small homeowner association fee of about $360 a year. The net income on the property is going to be about $1,865 per month, or about 10% on your cash purchase if you paid cash. Now, something significant in this community that I've never been able to offer in any other community in the last few years, unless I use really expensive private money debt at only about 50% loan to value, is we have foreign financing here at more competitive rates than I've seen before, not as competitive as what a U.S. Investor could have if they had a Social Security number and great credit, but probably the best rates I've seen for foreign investors. And the way it breaks down, we have a couple different programs available. And here I use the more conservative assumption that you're doing stated income, which means that you don't have to produce any income documents. You just have to produce proof that you are employed. And I'll cover that in a second. But with that financing, you have about 65% loan to value. So you have a 35% down payment, a 9% rate, on a 30-year amortization schedule, which puts your monthly payments at about $1,140 a month. By the way, that is your rent that you're getting is two times your monthly loan payments. So your debt service coverage ratio is about two times, a little bit more than two times. But at the end of the day, after all your expenses, after your out-of-pocket investment of about $83,000, you're about a 10% return on your cash. That's your cash-on-cash return. From a safety perspective, if you're risk-averse and you kind of want to know what my break-even or your break-even point is going to be, as long as you rent the property for about 8 months, then you covered all your debt service, you covered all your taxes, insurance, property management fees, and your upkeep. The three-bedroom townhomes that we have are priced at $245,000. They start at $245,000. They go up to $278,000. And the monthly rents on those is $3,100 a month. Again, that's a guarantee on your first tenant as far as placement of your first tenant. And the cap rate on that is about 12%. So on a cash purchase, after all your annual expenses, you're at about 12% on your cash. If you have a leveraged purchase and you gear that up with the same financing, then you're at about 16% return on your cash, about $93,000 out of pocket, $93,000. And again, I'd be happy to send these to you if you want to see them in more detail or kind of plug and play with your own assumptions. The property management component, of course, if you're owning properties remotely, your experience lies squarely on the shoulders of the property management company. And I pretty much scoured the United States for the best property management company I could find. And National Rental Services, their group was the one that stepped up to come into the market, put resources in place, and frankly, they just want to dominate that market there. So the way that we have structured the fee structure there is very investor friendly. A lot of times, if you're a remote investor, you know how frustrating it is for you to look at your income and expense statement and see a lot of nickel and dime maintenance costs. And the reason for that is because compensation drives behavior. A lot of management companies make anywhere up to 50 to 60% of their profit off of maintenance kickbacks or maintenance overrides or fees for calling people to come out and fix stuff with your property. One thing I do not like is when the property management company's fee structure is not aligned with the investor's profit motive. So one thing that was very important to us with National Rental Services was that they shed that maintenance component on their profit margins. So now the only way they make money is when they perform. Basically, they make money when rents are collected and when tenants are placed or when somebody renews, and that's as simple as it gets. You don't get nickel and dimed. You don't have to pay them more when they go to evict a tenant. You just cover costs. So when there's maintenance on the property or when somebody has to be evicted, there's pain and inconvenience for the management company. You cover costs, but there's no profit, so it's an inconvenience to them. And that's something that I really value about our property management solution there. I can't say that anybody else does that. The other thing is that there is a, for those of you who doubt these rents or you're concerned that you're going to close on the property and there may be a month or two when you don't collect rents and you're still making a debt payment, you don't have to worry about that because we do have a tenant placement guarantee, which says that those rents that you just saw in those cash flow performance there, those cash flow summaries, that is the rent, that top line rent is what you're going to get your lease with a qualified tenant that is going to stay there for at least 12 months. So if you want to know more about the property management company, you can simply go to BakkenPM.com, BakkenPM for property management.com, and you can research this a little bit more. As far as the tenant screenings go, when I mentioned a qualified tenant is this. This is how we define that. All adults have to be screened who are going to be staying in the property. It's not good enough for just to have husband and or wife. It's going to be everybody that's going to be in the property. The identities are verified. We keep a copy of the front and back of their driver's licenses on file. Their driver's license and social security numbers are validated to match the two so that you don't have someone ducking out on you in the middle of the night, and you have no recourse if you don't have the right person, obviously. Proof of incomes, we keep a copy of the last two pay stubs on file, or if they have a P&L because they're a business owner, we need to see the last 30 days of checks received. We keep a copy of those on file. We need to make sure that the rent or their incomes are three times the rent. If it's not at least three times the rent, then their income doesn't qualify to be in our properties. Credit scores of 650 or higher. We will take tenants who don't have, if there's three people applying, if none of them have a 650, we will take them, but we need to have somebody who's going to be a guarantor that has a better credit than 650, and that person will go through the same screening process as everybody else. Even if they're not in the resident, because they're serving as the credit guarantor. Criminal background checks we check as well. Want to make sure there are no violent felonies in anybody's past that are going to be in the neighborhood with all the kids running around and so forth. And then we also cross-reference everybody against the sex offenders list. So a lot of times, tell you the feedback that we get from tenants that are applying is especially if you have kids. I know that if you're in an environment where you have a male-dominant environment up there, like the oil workers and so forth, security is a very big issue for women in the area. And so when you know that you're screening everybody that is renting properties in that neighborhood like this, then it gives everybody just a little bit more peace of mind, not to mention that we are the only gated community in Williston. So at the end of the day, we're not in this. All of my investors have my personal cell phone number on speed dial on their cell phones. I'm still talking to investors that I've helped across the country invest in other parts for the last 5 years. So if you ever need to get a hold of us, you have my personal phone number handy. We're not just here to get you into the property. We want to see you through it, the full cycle. So we will be helping you with your exit strategy when you do decide to sell in the future as well. The financing for foreign investors, we have a couple different programs available. The one program is the 6535. The other program we have, for those of you that want a little bit more competitive rate and you're willing to put a little bit more money down, is a 50-50 program where you can get about a 7.5% rate. But there will be loan minimums that actually don't even apply in this market because all of our prices exceed the loan minimums. The amortization schedule, the monthly payments are calculated on a 30-year amortization, so they're really low, positive for your cash flow. And they have anywhere from a 5 to 7 year balloon, which means that at the 5 year mark, you either had to have established your U.S. credit to refinance, which some of you may want to do. There is no prepayment penalties on these. Or you can just pay it off at the time, or maybe you've already exited and sold the property by then. But there'll be anywhere from a 5 to 7 year balloon payment when the loan matures. And then the rates, again, depending on if you want to show income or full docs or you want to just do stated income, it's going to be anywhere between 7.5% to 9%. By the way, logistically, I can walk you through how we do our closings. You don't physically have to be in the United States. You don't have to be in front of a banker to open up a local checking account. We can handle your paperwork remote. And if you need to, because you can't get to the U.S. consulate's office to get a U.S. notary, you can get a power of attorney, which is a document basically allowing a local attorney to close on your behalf, if that makes it more convenient for you. So in summary, just kind of bring it down, we pretty much viewed the market like a funnel. The other alternatives in the country that I've seen, I've looked at, I know that whether you believe in it or not, I always say this, what drives, you know, America kind of takes what she wants. And if you've been watching the media, that's basically what happens. And so from a military imperialism perspective to agricultural dominance to economic dominance, all of that is driven by cheap oil. So we know that geopolitically speaking, this could be the most important thing happening in the U.S., if not globally, to, number one, keep us oil independent from OPEC, which is a very strong motivator here. So from a big picture, there's a lot of pressure for us politically to keep driving what's happening in North Dakota. So from a macro, the macro story is right, and the longevity is there. If you just do some basic math on the drilling, even on very conservative assumptions, if your strategy is to be in and be out within 5 to 7 years, is there going to be yield compression? I think so. Is it going to be significant and fall off a cliff? I definitely don't believe that. And if there is, we're going to see it happen gradually. It's not going to happen right away. So I think in the short-term time horizon I think most of the time frames that a lot of investors I've spoken to plan on holding these properties up there, we're all safe. The worst-case scenarios on these, I showed you the debt service coverage ratios. And how much you need to rent it for to break even, very conservative, anywhere from 7 to 8.5 months will cover all your expenses. So for something drastic would have to happen at the end of the day for you to be reaching into your pocket to carry your properties up there. And then, of course, the last thing is the people. I'd encourage you, if you're curious about anything that you've seen today, validate everything that I've mentioned to you. If you like resources, independent resources, to validate some of the homework you're doing, then just feel free to hit us up, and I'd be glad to send those links to you or point you the right direction. But if you feel comfortable with the people on the ground and the rest of the story fits, then I'd be happy to talk to you about available inventory and how you move forward. So with that, that concludes my summary of the market there. Is there anything that John or Larry or Ron that you guys would like to add?
I haven't had any questions pop up on the question board.
John, so.
Sorry, Larry, go on.
I'll ask a quick question. John, you may have covered it. I had a little family issue here to run away for a couple minutes, but you talked about the prices and the rents and so forth. How does that relate to the incomes over there?
How does it relate to the incomes?
Yeah, did you touch on the income or did I miss it?
We went over a couple of the cash flow summaries, and I'd be glad to get the details to anybody so they can kind of see them.
I mean the income, the household income.
Sorry, the household incomes, yeah.
Yes.
You know what, that's a really good question, because at the end of the day, home values and rents basically follow affordability, which is dictated by your local incomes relative to rent costs and housing costs, right? So the income levels there, the average income is about $77,000. The average in the U.S. between 48 and 50 household income, there it's like 77,000. And keep in mind that when you take out the service industry and you're only considering people who work in gas and oil, which is a lot of folks, we have a lot of 20-some-year-olds that are making, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a month. Your average incomes are about 90, I think they said it was 91, 92,000.
So it's definitely affordable. Those high rents are definitely affordable for those folks.
Yeah, and you know, you keep in mind some of these people have houses back home that they're getting rid of as well. So they're carrying two households and they're still coming in clear on their rent to income ratios.
That's awesome.
Very rarely are we disqualifying somebody on the tenant screenings because they don't have the incomes.
That's wonderful.
I've just had a couple of questions pop up. One of them has always been a problem for us, and that's in relation to opening bank accounts. You mentioned you can open bank accounts. There's obviously no difficulty with that. We don't have to be there, just sign documents and the accounts get open. Is that kind of the way it works? You have somebody to organize that for people?
I didn't mention the bank accounts. That we don't have a solution, at least I don't right now, on how we do that remotely, only because for security reasons, our banks have been so stringent on that. So, I'm in the same boat that you're in. We don't have a solution for that. What I was saying that we could do from a remote location is close the loan documentation without physically being present in the U.S.
Okay.
What we can't do, though, is open up a bank account. So we would just send you your checks quarterly or monthly or until you open up a bank account in the U.S. because you were physically here. Then at that point we can do automatic deposit on a monthly basis.
Yeah, that's one of the big issues for us as investors is that we do need to travel to the U.S. to open a bank account, which seems a little bit silly, but that's just the way it works. But there is another reason we have to travel overseas as well, and that is that a lot of people don't realize, but in Australia we get, because of the dual taxing arrangements between the two countries, any tax that we pay in the US is given to us as a foreign tax credit here in Australia. But in order to claim that foreign tax credit, we have had to have been overseas at the time we made the decision to invest in the US. So we actually do have to go overseas, even though we don't necessarily have to go to the U.S. We do actually have to go overseas and document our decision to invest while we're there. It's a little bit odd. Now, somebody's also asked a question about whether these properties or this type of property would be suitable for our self-managed super funds. The quick answer to that question is yes, they would, but only as an outright purchase, not with the finance. So if you are thinking about getting your self-managed super fund involved in this type of deal, then it would have to be on that basis. It would have to be a cash deal. Now, I've also had somebody ask for the URL for the site. Did I see that? Was that barkinpm.com? Was that the website that people need to go to?
Yeah, barkinpm.com, BAKKEN.com. Or I'm sorry, BAKKENPM, as in propertymanagement.com. That is just for the property management company. which frankly is more important than anything else. But as far as the other details, information about the physical properties, it's ever changing. So I send that to you on a request.
Oh, yeah.
When it's requested.
No, I just see that they're actually referring to a local site, and I'll provide that myself. They're the only questions, but from what I've seen, that should be very attractive. Some of those returns, the cash-on-cash returns in particular with the financing, seem to be very attractive. And one of the things that has always been a problem here, as you may be aware, is that investing in our own mining towns here in Australia is something like going on a roller coaster ride when it comes to rental returns. They're up one year, down the next, and you know, it's really quite horrific what's happening in our mining towns. And a lot of that has come about because the mining companies have decided that rather than house people in the towns, they actually use them, they fly in, fly out. They find it cheaper to fly people into and out of a town in order to do their shifts rather than to actually accommodate them in town. That's not likely to happen in places like Wilson.
That's a really good point, and I didn't even bring that up. What you're starting, the climate up there is changing. First of all, let me say this. Williston is the kind of the center of commerce. It's the center of the wheel, and then you have all the spokes of the wheel branching out to all the different the minor markets around. When I say minor, I mean M-I-N-O-R, not E-R. The smaller markets around the Bakken region where a lot of the drilling is happening, the smaller towns. And so Williston's where you have they just finished a $66 million recreational facility. It's the largest publicly owned fitness/rec center by it's owned by the Department of Parks and Recreation. And they have the airport there. They've got the State College there. You have a lot of retail. You have a place where wives and kids want to move. And now what you're seeing is the local companies, corporations, and the local government, because they're going to be putting in another $100 million of infrastructure over the next 5 to 6 years, that of like really important infrastructure. They already put $1 million to replace all the playgrounds and upgrade all the playgrounds in the area in that city of Williston. All of this is going in because you're starting to see this transition from temporary employment, which is basically what you described what they were doing in 2008, 9, and 10. Now you're starting to see more of the permanent move. So once you hit about the 10,000 well mark, then it doesn't become a boom anymore. It starts to become an industry. And so you have a lot of these companies based out of Houston that are opening up their multi-million-dollar facilities in the area. They're planning themselves there. Their promotions are going to employees that are actually relocating families, making the permanent move to the area, and starting their lives there, just like you would in any other market in the U.S. if you got a job transfer. That's why we wanted to focus on permanent housing. You have a lot of the man camps and workforce lodging where you have super high yields, but there's a lot of volatility that comes with that, to your point. And if you look at any commercial package, the revenues drop over time on those packages because they are accounting for that going away and or a lot of more temporary housing coming, where in permanent housing we take a hit on the yields short term, but we have a lot more stability. And with permanent housing, because it's a lower yielding product, you don't have institutions coming in and overbuilding it. So people who do residential houses are people who care about building residential houses and doing nice neighborhoods. So it was a great point that you brought up there, John. We are seeing a transition now where, especially in Williston, where you have more families relocating and people start planning their lives.
Okay, well, thanks for that. I don't have any other questions. Larry, or I haven't seen Ben on at the moment, but maybe if there are no more questions, then what I'll do is I'll take back the screen and show my screen, and then we can just go on to doing Larry's thing. Just a second, I'll just get that going here. Can you see my screen now?
Yeah, I see it.
Yep. Okay, over to you, Larry.
I lost the screen. There we go. Yeah, this basically, these three slides just kind of validate residential investments here in the U.S. Now, you obviously just heard about the vacant North Dakota opportunities, which are going to skew these national numbers. We always say there is no such thing as a national number or a national real estate market. The markets we talked to you about are obviously much more superior than this. But looking at information as a whole from country to country, if you will, in the big blue, you basically see single family homes is the number one rental class that is sought after, the single family homes, and that's of course everything you heard about there tonight. You got to jump all the way to the 50 units or more to hit the number two spot. So that might lose some of us private investors, as that gets to be a pretty big investment. But it just goes to validate that residential property, especially that single family home, is a very, very highly sought after investment class.
Next one.
This is kind of interesting. It actually, a slide actually only goes till June of 2012, as you can see. But if you look back at the 2010 and so forth, and you look at the variation, the gold bar talks about the home value index versus the blue bar, which is rent index. You'll see there in about June of 2011 how that crossed over, and it continues to be a very big spread there. It's basically illustrating that as of June of 2011, it's become a very powerful investment for buying these single-family homes and renting them out. As the rent demand is so strong, prices of rentals are going up, and it's become a very lucrative investment class. This kind of goes to validate, and the next chart will illustrate that even a little bit more. You see back in 2004, that's a full 10 years, and you can see how the rental demand for rental housing has been almost a straight shot up right into 2014, and that, of course, that trend is expected to continue. I might also mention the millennials here, which are basically your young adults. I believe it's 18 to age 30, somewhere in there. Many of those folks have been living at home with mom and dad. They call them basement kids, and basically living in the lower half of their folks' house. And as the economy is rebounding, those millennials are getting back out there. They're young professionals, if you will. They're getting out into the rental world. Like most people, they don't go into buying a house right away. They go into renting. So the rental demand in the U.S. is very, very strong, continuously growing. I think those three charts illustrate that. And, of course, the first chart talked about single-family home being the most highly sought-after investment class. Just kind of validate everything that John Chin had talked about a little bit ago over in the Beacon, North Dakota area. It's just going to be a strong market moving forward. And that's about all I have to share, unless you have some questions. Anybody there?
No questions here, Larry.
All right. I think we're good if we still have our host. You still there, John Bone?
Sorry,
I know John had earlier talked about running out.
It's okay. I was talking to myself. I had myself muted, which was a little bit silly. I was just talking to myself.
Oh, I do that too.
And I was actually trying to think of how to calculate minus 20 into Celsius, and I gave up. That's very cold.
It's cold.
I think when it gets down so low, the numbers actually meet each other, Fahrenheit and Celsius.
Yeah, I think so. I certainly wouldn't want to experience it, thanks. But, yeah, thank you both, Larry and John, for giving us your time and the presentation. It was great. And if people want to make any contact, then barkinpm.com or realwealthnetwork.com, and I'm sure all your questions will get answered. As I said, we certainly appreciate your time and have a good evening, and I'll close it down there. Thank you very much.
Sounds good. Thanks, everybody.
Great.